In this series, Musings from Prashanthi Nilayam, Radio Sayana presents a talk by Professor G. Venkatraman, former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a continuation of my last week's talk, in which I began responding to two questions from listeners about God. If you recall, one listener was essentially quoting a scientist who, in turn quoting Einstein, dismissed God as an invention of humans. In a sense, this question dealt with God at the level of the formless, or as we would say, with Nirakara Brahman. The other questioner was worried about how to sustain his faith in Swami in the light of constant negative propaganda. Roughly speaking, in the last talk, I was mainly addressing the first listener, and the essence of what I said might be summarized as follows. 1. We humans are conscious beings. Even scientists who do not believe in God accept that fact. 2. There is an aspect of this awareness or being conscious that goes beyond the mere external world. There are times when even atheists face an ethical dilemma and worry about whether a thing is right or wrong. 3. Although atheists would not concede it, if one examines from the Vedantic point of view, the question why humans have this worry about right and wrong, then one would have to conclude, as Mahatma Gandhi did, that this concern about right and wrong arises because there is an overriding moral law that governs the entire universe. 4. Our nature, intrinsic nature that is such that it is tunable to this moral law, which is why humans worry about right and wrong, whereas a monkey or a tiger does not and in fact cannot. 5. The question now becomes, what gets tuned to what? Vedanta gives the answer. It says, the atmic aspect within you seeks to tune to the Atma that is present everywhere. Sometimes a resonance is achieved, and when it is, the person concerned leads a moral life. If that tuning does not take place, then the person throws morality to the winds and does what he wants. That is the essence of what I said last time. Now, this tuning business that I just referred to becomes possible only when one strives for strict sense and mind control, or Trikarna Suddhi as Swami refers to it. The four Mahavakyas to which I made a reference last time basically stress the oneness of the individual with the cosmic infinite. Seeking that oneness is what I colloquially refer to just now as tuning. So in brief, whatever Einstein may say, or for that matter Lawrence Krauss who quotes Einstein may say, the fact is that we are conscious beings and we do have ethical concerns. If we accept that, then it is fair to say that it is not a mere accident. Drawing upon the huge and many hints that quantum mechanics is providing all the time, I believe we are forced to accept that consciousness pre-exists creation. That's important. You may recall that last time I argued that even according to science, without energy it is impossible to create the universe and all that it contains. However, this energy has to be something more than the physical energy E that features in Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared. Physical energy E of Einstein can certainly create inert matter, as has been shown in the laboratory by numerous experiments, but it simply cannot produce any awareness or consciousness. Thus, although scientists may deny God as much as they want to, they can in no way explain where from this consciousness arises, especially if they stick to what is within the framework of space and time alone. That, by the way, is the boundary of science. Since consciousness actually exists in the universe and cannot be dismissed, we cannot avoid concluding that there must be something that is the mother of consciousness and awareness, such as we all experience. And that something is what I earlier referred to as pure consciousness. One thing I did not mention earlier is that this pure or absolute consciousness has embedded in it divine energy, which we sometimes refer to as Shakti. In fact, Shiva and Parvati are names for pure consciousness and divine energy, no doubt intimately tied together before creation. So in short, according to Vedanta, since the universe came from consciousness, and we all say the universe came from God, it follows that consciousness is nothing but God. Since all this is discussed in greater detail in my articles in H2H on the quest for infinity, I shall not go into this any further. Instead, I shall turn to the issues raised by listener number 2. If you recall, this listener has been exposed, as he himself puts it, to Swami for over 20 years. And just to remind you, he profiles himself as follows. I quoted this last time and I am quoting it again. Being pulled into the Sai circle by a strange sequence of events, introduction to him, amazement at his glory both witnessed and heard, physical proximity, monotony creeping in, and boredom, cynicism, loss of faith, going away both physically and mentally from him, finally being pulled back into his fold with a miraculous suddenness and force that must only be experienced to be believed. To summarize the above, at first this person did not know anything about Swami, which is the case with almost all of us. He was then pulled to Swami, as he himself describes it, after which he was swept and amazed, and then started feeling bored. Next came a period of some cynicism that let him drift far away. He then felt pain and a sense of loss, began to yearn again for Swami, and came back with miraculous suddenness, as he himself describes it. You may say, okay, he came, he saw, he drifted away and then came back. Where's the problem? The listener has described precisely what his problem is, and I made a brief reference to it last time. Perhaps I should refer to it again, briefly of course. The problem of the second listener is that though he started believing in Swami once more, he is troubled by a video that is floating around somewhere and to which his attention appears to have been drawn. As I understand it, this listener does not believe in the video which appears to be anti-Swami, but he does not know how to refute the allegations to his friends who are non-believers. I sympathize with the writer and would like to present my remarks step by step. Forget about the video and all that. To hear Swami declare, "I am God," comes as a tremendous shock to most people, especially when they hear it for the first time. I must confess it was so to me. I asked myself, come on, how can anyone make a claim like that? It was only much later, when I struggled through innumerable discourses of Swami, various bits and pieces of Vedanta, as also the Gita, that I realized that all are God, and indeed there is nothing else but God. I finally began to make sense of Swami's remark, "I am God and so are you. The difference is, I know it, but you do not." After a tremendous amount of reflection and thinking, I have finally understood it in my head and can even manage to explain the entire idea to others. It is a different matter though if you ask me, is your heart feeling 100% like God? Well, no comments on that right now. Let me get back to listener number 2. Most people get shocked to hear Swami say he is God, because we are totally unused to the idea that God actually can stand before us and talk to us. Somehow we have been trained to believe that God is separate from us, very far away, sitting before a huge control system, perhaps with millions of buttons on it, perhaps like a mega science fiction movie, pressing buttons and pulling levers to reward some person somewhere or punish a real bad guy somewhere else. It is, of course, to be expected if some people of the Christian or indeed any of the Abrahamic religions, as they are called, take this concept most seriously. Those religions make no bones about the fact that God is separate from us. But Vedanta has a very radically different point of view, which is that we are all nothing but embodiments of one omnipresent God, though with various physical forms. Having said that, there is a difference between saying or declaring one is God and truly acting like God. So, the question now becomes, how does one recognize a person who is a true reflection of divinity? I shall deal with this question in two parts, in the first of which, I shall go back to a remark made by Gandhi, defining God, so to speak. If you recall, in my last talk, I made a reference to a spiritual message recorded by Gandhiji during his visit to England in 1931 in connection with the Second Roundtable Conference. In the course of that recorded message, Gandhi observes, and I quote, "He is no God who merely satisfies the intellect. God, to be God, must rule the heart and transform the senses." End of quote. Now, the reason why I am offering this quote is because many people, especially in the West, try to prove that God exists by a sort of logical analysis or a reasoning process. In fact, they look for clues about the existence of God via science. What Gandhi is saying is that God is not something that is manifest to the intellect. Some of you may recall Swami quoting the Vedas, which emphatically declared that God is beyond words and indeed the mind itself. Thus, proving that God exists in the way one proves a theorem in mathematics is sheer nonsense, to put it bluntly. In that case, one might ask, how would one recognize God or godliness for that matter? The answer to that can be stated in many ways. Gandhi gives one answer. He says, just as a magnet can magnetize a piece of iron and endow it with magnetic properties, God would transform an ordinary person and make him godly. Okay, but what does it mean to say a person is godly? Krishna gives the answer to that one. He says that wherever virtue shines, there one can see the radiance of the divine. In that person, you can see godliness. Let me now gather the various points I have been making so far, so that they hang together. They are as follows. 1. God is everywhere, immanent in creation in every entity, both animate and inanimate. 2. This means God is also in us. That's what Krishna says when he tells Arjuna, "Arjuna, you are the Atma." 3. This is also what Swami means when he tells us, "I am in you." 4. Since God is in us, we need to exhibit divine attributes in our actions, rather than behaving like animals, or worse, like demons. 5. Which is why Swami says, first stop behaving like an animal and start behaving like a human being. Next, try to rise from the level of the human to the level of the divine. Now, all this would be meaningful in the Vedantic view of God and creation, but not so much in the Western view of God and creation. God is thus to be seen in terms of noble qualities and virtues, rather than in terms of a being that is separate and acting most of the times like a judge come headmaster. Perhaps, at this point, I could mention several examples of how Swami silently transforms when the time comes. This would reinforce Gandhi's description of God that I quoted earlier and give weight to it. My first example concerns a person whom I shall just call Mr. Soni. His full story appears in a recent issue of Heart to Heart, and therefore in this talk I shall merely give the headlines, so to speak. I should interrupt here to state that in cases like this, the name of the person concerned is either withheld or changed. However, since in this case the person concerned is quite public about his past mistakes and wants to proclaim what made him change, I take a liberty that normally is not. To get on with the story, the gentleman belongs to the sales tax department of the state of Madhya Pradesh, a huge state right in the middle of India. Now, it's no big secret that the sales tax departments all over the country are generally full of corrupt officials. And it's no surprise, therefore, that the gentleman I am referring to was also deep into taking bribes without any inhibition whatsoever. One day, somehow, this Mr. Soni happened to hear about Sai Baba, and that changed his entire life. Mind you, at that time he had never seen Swami. It was just hearing about Swami that totally changed him and made him swear never to be corrupt again. I mean, this sort of thing hardly happens. And if it did, does not that tell you its own story? And now please recall what Gandhi said. Just to remind you, he said, if there is a God, he must rule the heart and transform the senses. In this case, just hearing about Sai Baba was sufficient to stop this person from being greedy and getting money by improper means. I have met this gentleman several times subsequent to this transformation. In fact, he now comes here regularly and actually works with our studio on many projects. And how passionate he is about spreading the message of Swami. Another such transformation story, and this one is not about a bad man becoming good, but rather about a good man becoming much better, transforming in just 4 hours, simply by reading a book about Swami. The person concerned is Dr. Jivanandam, whose parents migrated a long time ago from India to the US. Dr. Jiva is a famous heart transplant surgeon in America, presently in the University of Chicago. Prior to this, he was in Pennsylvania, and he told me at that time, as a young and bright doctor in America with the wide world open in front of him, he was totally focused on money, fast cars, luxury goods, dining in expensive restaurants, etc., and everything that was a symbol of status that money could get. His parents were devotees of Swami, but Dr. Jiva carefully excluded Swami from entering his life, as he felt that would be detrimental to his ambitions. And then one weekend, when he flew as usual from Pennsylvania to Phoenix, Arizona, where his parents lived, he picked up in the last minute a book on Swami for reading on the plane. He read the book during the long flight, and when he got down at the destination, he was a changed man. Radio Sai is broadcast, I guess, several times, my conversation with Dr. Jiva, and so I won't say anything further at the moment. Right now my point is this. Here is another instance of transformation that exactly matches Gandhi's specifications. You want one more? Here it is. I heard this personally from a Japanese software engineer way back in 1998, when I was in Japan to participate in and give a talk in their biannual National Sai Meet. The meeting was in Osaka, and I had arrived earlier in Tokyo. On the day of the departure to Osaka, Mr. Hira, then the guiding spirit of the Sai movement in Japan, asked this software engineer to take me from Tokyo to Osaka by the famous bullet train. There was plenty of time for a long chat, during which I asked this gentleman, "How did you become a devotee of Swami?" He answered that some years earlier, he was working for an American company, and once while traveling from Tokyo to America, he picked up a book at the airport bookstall, and that book happened to be on Swami. At that time, believe it or not, there were many books in Japanese on Swami that were sold in bookshops in Japan, and that was because there was often Swami-related news on Japanese television. My traveling companion told me that reading that book changed him so much that he took a job with a Bangalore software company so that he could often come to India on work and have Swami's darshan. Imagine that. To continue on the same theme, just recently I saw a leading orthopedic surgeon from overseas come to Prashanti for a two-day international conference on orthopedics. He was coming here for the first time and had never seen Swami before, probably never heard of him also. Merely seeing Swami on the veranda made a deep and visible impression on him. All of us could see it. And when he took leave of Swami on the veranda, there were tears in his eyes. Those who were close by saw it and were deeply touched. Later, he wrote a letter to Swami that was full of feeling. How do I know? Because Swami himself made a mention of that letter, and that's how I came to know about it. I hope the various examples just provided are sufficient to reinforce my point that Gandhi's guidelines provide a neat way of resolving the issue of defining God and recognizing God in human form. I prefer to make my decision about Swami based on the Gandhi criterion rather than a video somewhere, especially since videos can be easily doctored. There is another criterion that I would like you to consider while discussing the issue of God in human form, and that is the aspect of selfless sacrifice. Now, the scriptures describe God as the ultimate in selfless sacrifice, and in fact, that is why one of the names given to God is Tyagaraja, or the King of Sacrifice. Now, if you talk to Swami about his sacrifice, he would dismiss it with a big smile. His standard observation is, sacrifice is what humans do because while sacrificing, they subconsciously at least calculate how much they are giving up, how much they are losing, etc. For Swami, giving in whatever form it is a part of his nature, and he gives and gives non-stop because that is the way he experiences ananda or bliss. Swami's life viewed as a saga of glorious sacrifice is too huge to be recalled in this talk, and maybe some other time I shall deal with it in extenso. For the present, I would just say to a second listener, dear friend, don't allow others to make up your mind. You would please do it for yourself. The world is always full of detractors, and there is not one saint or sage who has not been maligned or abused. That is why as far back as 1947, indeed even before India had become free, Swami wrote to his elder brother that it is only the tree laden with ripe fruits that attracts pick stones. In fact, if you talk to real old-timers or read books by them, you would invariably find that they narrate painful incidents of how Swami used to be abused by the locals around here. That, however, was a long time ago. And things have changed as far as the local situation is concerned. But in the wide world outside, where Swami is not well known, ill-informed criticism still continues. Be that as it may, there is no reason to be swayed by the flawed arguments of others, when we are in a position, and a much better one in fact, to come to our own conclusions. So that is my brief message to the second listener. Continuing, I would like to say that there is one more thing I would like to mention before I wind up. As I gather my thoughts for this talk, the calendar says it's 6th August. Does that date ring a bell? Maybe not. In fact, it is the anniversary of the dropping of the first atomic bomb way back in 1945. I do not remember that event, but I distinctly recall the dropping of the Nagasaki bomb that happened 3 days later, 3 days after Hiroshima was destroyed, that is to say on 9th August 1945. I was then a young boy, and I was watching a cricket match in the police commissioner's ground in Karachi. Yes, Karachi, for that was where I was then. I heard the elders talking about the bomb, but did not understand then what it was all about. Only a few years later did I understand it better. And it was when I actually visited Hiroshima in 1998 that the full implication of the destruction that a nuclear weapon can cause hit me like a ton of bricks. There is a reason why I bring up Hiroshima at this point. And that reason is that almost by coincidence, The funeral was taking place in England on 6th August 2009 of the last British soldier who fought in the trenches of France during World War I. I do not remember the name of this soldier, but he was 111 years old when he died. Till he turned 100, this surviving soldier never spoke of the horrors he had witnessed. But after that, suddenly he changed and talked ceaselessly of nothing but permanent peace and the need to resolve all conflicts via negotiations. He wanted that his funeral must be simple and attended by soldiers both from France, which was an ally of England in World War I, and Germany, which of course was the adversary. That was done. Now, what is the symbolism of these two events, a vigil in Hiroshima on August 6, 2009, and a funeral in Britain taking place on the same day? The symbolism relates to the futility of war and the murderous destruction it causes. Wars are always fought in the belief that they would bring peace. Sometimes they appear to, but it is seldom a lasting peace. Mostly it's just a lull in the fighting while getting ready for the next big conflict. Once in a while, people gather on anniversary days or at funerals, just as I described, and lament man's folly. But barely a few hours later, it is business as usual. Years ago, Swami said, and I quote, "Alongside the growth in scientific knowledge, ignorance is also growing pari passu. How else can we explain the fact that in 5,000 years of recorded history, there have been as many as 15,000 wars? Even now, men are not free from the fear of war. It is these wars that have progressively dehumanized mankind and eroded all human values. It is meaningless to aspire for peace in the streets and villages without peace in home. These days, it has become a fashion to pray for peace. Meetings are arranged for establishing peace in the world. Keeping the atom bomb in one hand, people shout for peace. Even by journeying to the moon, man cannot get peace. Peace is within you and not on the moon. It is better to travel half an inch into the heart than to journey hundreds of thousands of miles to the moon." End of quote. Now, why do I bring all this up? For one important reason. If there is one thing that stands out in Swami's life, it is the amount of time he has spent giving discourses and painstakingly introducing us to the subtle nuances of spirituality. Not only that, he has tirelessly given of himself in order to establish a strong example of how an educational system should be set up and operated, with the primary objective of developing character. Do you know that there was a time when about 70% of his time Swami was giving to students just to groom them? Show me one example of a person anywhere in the world who has devoted so much time to students for so many years that too. That is what we call sacrifice. But you ask Swami, he will say, no, that's not sacrifice, it is love. What educators ought to be doing as a part of their normal duty, Swami does as an expression of his unbounded love. And that really is what love without duty is all about. Now, some of you may remember that in the Gita, Krishna says, "Arjuna, in all the three worlds that exist and I have created, I have absolutely no duty to perform. Yet, here I am on earth, doing things that could be called duty. Do you know why I do that? Not because I have any obligations, but because I wish to set an example to you, humans." Keeping that in mind, let us take a look at the life of our dear Swami. He is all the time doing something or the other for our sake, without any thought about himself. Why? Because it's in his nature to give himself entirely to us. In other words, it is not any obligation, responsibility or sense of duty that makes him set up schools, universities and hospitals, or build hundreds of houses for people who have lost everything in disastrous floods, or even deliver hundreds of discourses. It is love, pure love in fact, that makes him do so. That is why he says that giving out of sheer pure love rather than discharging a duty is entirely divine. I hope you are able to follow the point. Before I conclude, I would like to recall what the wise have said before. They say, scholars often argue that reason must come first, while belief can come later. A free translation of this would be, the head is the gateway to the heart. Adding that scholars are absolutely wrong, the wise continue, start believing without any reason, have faith without any reason, and soon you would discover a profound reason to believe. That is another way of saying that the heart always comes first and the head only later. In general, where God is concerned, the latter is the correct option. That is also what Swami says, Atma first and mind next. A few parting words to the two people who sent questions that triggered these two special musings. I am not sure if you are satisfied with my response, but you know, these are questions that are best dealt with via one-on-one discussion or dialogue. That, of course, is not possible, and so please let me wrap up as follows. One, the question of whether or not God exists is a question in the abstract, because God is supposed to be, even in the Abrahamic religions, beyond this world, which really means beyond space and time. Two, in discussing this issue, it is useful to keep in mind the famous Gödel theorem of mathematics. Taking huge liberties, the proposition of Gödel may be paraphrased as follows. Within the framework of any logical system, there exist questions for which a definite yes or no answer or a true or false answer cannot be given, even though one knows that a particular proposition is true. What it means is that even if one knows there is an answer and it is a clear yes or a clear no, within the framework under discussion, a definitive answer is simply not possible. To put it differently, if one wants to discuss whether or not God exists, one must go beyond space and time. Most atheists do not, and they try to stretch logic that is bounded by sense perception and space as well as time. According to Gödel, that cannot deliver the goods. Scientists may believe they are right in dismissing God purely by scientific reasoning, but they should understand that when something exists beyond space and time, it is not meaningful to dismiss that something within the domains of space and time. If they do so, they are not logical. At least on that basis, atheists should withdraw politely, saying, if you want to believe in God, go right ahead, but I am not going to. Instead, they run down the other guy as an idiot. I guess, if you point this out to them, their response would be, Gödel talked about logic, you stupid, whereas you are trying to defend faith. 5. On the other hand, if one goes by Vedanta, and I do not see why not, then in that case we find that faith has a logic of its own, that exists in a higher dimension, that of pure consciousness. 6. Thus, in the Vedantic picture, we get the following. A. God does exist as pure consciousness. B. From this pure consciousness was born the entire inanimate universe. C. In due course, life emerged in the inanimate universe and thereafter slowly evolved. D. And then came a turning point when consciousness, till then barely active, fully flowered in humans. E. This flowering can proceed to the amazing extent that where the individual actually shines with the radiance of divinity. 7. In this scenario, the appearance of the avatar as a special individual and the full radiance of divinity is a perfectly reasonable proposition. 8. And the avatar comes to remind us that all of us, without exception, do have the spark of divinity within us. Recognizing this, we should forthwith evoke that spark, make it into a blazing fire, and allow the fire to rage and burn up all the impurity within us, and in fact, with which the whole world is heavily polluted. 9. That is when the golden age would truly dawn, and not by simply hanging around and asking, Swami said the golden age would come, why has it not come till now? Is not the present horrible enough? Why is Swami waiting? 10. The answer to all the questions I mentioned just above is simple. Swami is waiting for us to clean up the mess. As they say, he who breaks the vase must fix it. You may or may not agree with the last remark, but at least you can think about it and raise a hackle if you disagree. Thanks for listening. God bless. Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor G. Venkatraman in the series Musings from Prashanti Nilayam. This broadcast came to you from the studios of Radio Sai.
Sai. Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Dear listeners, loving Sai Rams, and once again a warm welcome to today's Thursday Live. I am Raghu from Team Radio Sai. Well, the time right now in our studio is 11:50 a.m. and it's a warm afternoon here at Prashant Nilayam Ashram, and today is 7th of April. Well, before you listen to Professor Venkatraman's musings, I had asked you all a question. The question was, in Swami's childhood, when Swami was studying in school at Kamalapuram, Swami, along with his classmates, as part of the scout team, went to a fair in a nearby village to do service. So my question was, what was a fair and which was the village? So the correct answer was, it was a cattle fair in the Pushpagiri village nearby. In fact, dear listeners, the story goes that the scout team, about rupees 10 was collected from each student for participating in the service activity, and Swami couldn't pay 10 rupees, so Swami had to walk all the way from Kamalapuram to Pushpagiri to join the service activities. The distance is more than 10 kilometers, and Swami also didn't have the scout uniform to wear. But still Swami went and participated with all other boys who went to Pushpagiri in a bus. Well, dear listeners, about 7 of you have given me correct answer, and I would like to tell their names. Ms. Darini Narayanan, Mr. Sai Krishna from Hyderabad, Ms. Purna from Sharjah, Ms. Sweta Palekur, a young listener from Irvine, California, USA, Mr. Ajay Rajan from Chennai, Mr. V. Bharanidharan from New Delhi, and Ms. Jayashri Rangarajan. Well, for all of you, here's a big round of applause from Radio Sai team.